This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The old William B. Rogers Middle School in Hyde Park is about to have a new life and take on a pressing social problem. On June 17th, Pride will break ground there. That's the Pride, P-R-Y-D-E. And it's an affordable housing development for seniors that is designed explicitly to be welcoming for LGBTQ older adults. It's New England's first. We're joined now by Gretchen Van Ness. She is the executive director of LGBTQ Senior Housing, the nonprofit that's building the Pride. Welcome, Gretchen.
Tiziana, thank you so much for having us this morning.
Oh, very glad to have you. So just quickly, let's do a bit of nuts and bolts. How many units? All affordable? What do we got going?
It's 74 units altogether, and so that's a mix of studios, one and two bedrooms, and it's a range of affordability from 30%, 60%, 80%, and 100%. So we have a great mix of opportunities for folks to live there.
And you break ground on the 17th. How long does it take for something like this to be completed? When will someone move in?
Oh, we cannot wait for someone to move in. So we are in the process right now of cleaning out the building, and it's luckily a historic preservation and renovation of the existing school, and we expect that we will be opening our doors to our first residents in the fall, early fall of next year. So
that's
we're
quick.
Right around the corner. Yes,
that feels really quick.
It does. We're really kind of astonished. So this is the first project that LGBTQ Senior Housing is doing in Boston and all of New England, and as you said, it's our first explicitly LGBTQ welcoming senior housing. And they tell us that from conception to opening the doors for affordable housing is usually closer to a 10 or 15 or even 20-year process. And this task force that became LGBTQ Senior Housing was formed about 7.5 years ago. So we are doing this at lightning speed. And I think that part of the reason that it's happening so quickly is that everything has aligned to meet this very pressing need. And so many people have, along the road, have recognized how desperately we need this kind of housing.
Why? Why do we need it?
Well, we're talking about LGBTQ elders, the generation that grew up before there was a single anti-discrimination law in our country that protected gay people, when every single major religion in our country condemned us, when the Psychiatric Association said that we were mentally ill. And this is the generation that also survived the AIDS crisis. So as we think about, you know, our current pandemic and the losses and grief and trauma that we have experienced as a nation, the LGBTQ nation experienced that when the AIDS crisis first broke out. And so this is the generation that has most likely lost family and community support as they have grown up and most likely don't have that in their lives right now. So we know that there are about 65,000 LGBTQ elders in Massachusetts right now. They're much, much less likely than other older adults to have family, community, church support. So having a place to go that's affordable and welcoming where they can live their authentic lives is critical for their safety and health and well-being.
So I'm going to bring in another voice here, but quickly before I do, is there also historic distrust of the healthcare system or other forms of care systems based on previous bigotry and prejudice?
That's such a great question. And I think that that's correct. And so we're really talking about trying to overcome all kinds of ways that this generation, our elders, have experienced institutional hostility toward them.
All right, so I'm going to bring in another voice here. David Wilson was, along with his husband, Rob Compton, among the plaintiffs in the court case that won marriage equality here in the Commonwealth in 2003. That was Goodridge versus the Department of Public Health. So David now lives in Seashore Point, which is a 55 and up independent living community in Provincetown. It is not explicitly for LGBTQ elders there, but it is creating a community that is affirming. And we want to add David's voice here. David, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for asking me to join you.
So, David, you live in a community that feels affirming for age 55 plus LGBTQ couples and individuals. Tell us what that looks like for you.
Well, my husband and I were looking for a place in and around where we've been since we retired in 2015 in Provincetown. And Seashore Point was one of the only, and maybe the only, certainly in Outer Cape, a community that was welcoming. We actually knew couples and singles that lived here that were LGBTQ. And so we visited for over a year and finally decided this would be the right place for us. It's probably 70% LGBTQ. We also have Outer Cape Health Services, which is a part of the community, and doctors and nurses and healthcare workers come into Seashore Point to help with our residents. So this felt like not only a safe place, but a place that we could also receive health services if we needed them.
And so one more question to you there, David. I get instinctively 70% of the residents roughly are LGBTQ. That creates a sense of community and safety. Is there anything else that the development Seashore Point does that is affirming or particularly welcoming that's important to you and your husband?
Well, there are activities that take place in our complex. So we invite artists from the community. We invite LGBT entrepreneurs from the community, new writers, playwrights, anyone that in the community that may be from the LGBT community or at least supportive. So we get a chance to not only go out into our community and experience these activities, but bring them in. And often these activities are the only way for some of our residents to actually interact because they are 80, 85, 90 years old. And it's an opportunity to still be LGBT, interact with LGBT activists, advocates in the community, in our own space.
So we are talking about a new development that will launch in Hyde Park soon called The Pride, which will be New England's first explicitly LGBTQ welcoming residence for older adults. Just spoken with David Wilson there. David, stay with us. I'm going to turn back to Gretchen Van Ness here, who is the executive director of LGBTQ Senior Housing. So what's the vision? We know what the size of the facility is. We know what the need is, Gretchen. What will it mean for The Pride to be LGBTQ welcoming?
It's everything about how we've imagined this community and how we're creating it in this historic building. So one of the things that makes this building very special and the development plans that were approved by the City of Boston, we have an outstanding development partner, Penrose Companies, and we have an amazing architectural firm, DeMella Schaefer, that is overseeing and planning the historic renovation, is that we are turning the old gym in this high school into a 10,000 square foot public community center. So it's very unusual that affordable housing of any kind has this sort of public space. So we have that piece that will be a place where I think a lot of people don't know that there's no LGBTQ community center in all of Boston. So despite our progress and despite our leadership in this area over decades, we don't have a place where our community can come together. So we're going to sort of create the de facto LGBTQ community center for Boston. For Hyde Park, it becomes a public space and community center, which is also in rare supply in Hyde Park. So it's hard for community groups to find a place to meet. And so what makes this special is how this whole vision came together, who our partners and have been along the way and our supporters. So not only do we have overwhelming support among the Hyde Park neighbors, but our founders have reached out to every single LGBTQ community organization and institution around Boston and greater Boston. So the great people in the Gay Men's Chorus know what we're doing, and the History Project knows what we're up to. Bagley is a great friend of ours. Elders of Color has been on board since the very beginning. So there's been a partnership as we have envisioned the Pride and created it that will continue once it's open. And we're going to have actually office space for LGBTQ senior housing. I'll have a office, and there'll be a full-time program and services director just for the LGBT community in the Pride and for the community generally.
And of course, Gretchen, I don't want to underemphasize the affordability piece here.
Yes, and that's what makes our community so unique, I think, and also is daily a reminder to us of how critically important this is. So we're just little LGBTQ senior housing. We have a website. We have a Facebook page. We have one employee. That's me. And people find us from all over the country. We receive phone calls and emails and messages from folks who are living, trying to survive in places where there's no community support. So we know how critical this is. And so one of the things we're doing is hopefully raising funds to have a state-of-the-art AV and acoustics infrastructure in the building so that all of our programming and services will be accessible for people no matter where they are in the world and in the country and no matter what their abilities are as well.
So David Wilson, I'll turn back to you. Gretchen said a minute ago that there was no LGBTQ community center in the area despite years of progress and leadership. And I want to come to that point for a minute because we do We are arguably in a moment where nationally we are backsliding on LGBTQ rights, on our embrace and support of our LGBTQ neighbors. And I want to ask you to put in context that national trend and living in a safe, welcoming space as an older adult where we do become more vulnerable over time. Put that in context for us.
I think part of the question for me is how do we feel safe and comfortable and also be able to interact with the community around us? Most of our community and the residents here are here because the community has been welcoming over several decades. We have a council on aging, which is open to the community, but we are opening our space at Seashore Point also for activities, for opportunities, for communities, people to come in, residents to come in. So there's an interaction, I think, which is really necessary, especially as we age. We become less mobile. We're not able to get out into the community. So this space has become very safe, and it's also a space where we can invite others to come and join us if we're not able to get out.
And does this feel like a continuation in some way, David, of your activism and Rob's activism around marriage rights here in the Commonwealth 20 years ago?
Well, yes, we both joined the Residents Association. Rob is a trustee in our community here, and I chair the Residents Association. So we're actually helping to form committees that will work on social events, health and safety events, art events. So we are pushing forward with not only just events for ourselves, but events that include the community. So yes, we do feel like we are opening up opportunities, expanding opportunities for LGBT seniors and elders.
Gretchen, are you finding interest from other communities to model what LGBTQ senior housing is doing with the Pride?
Yes, absolutely. We've heard from folks in Cambridge and Somerville. I had the most amazing conversation several months ago with a group in Canada that's also looking at doing the same thing. So we know that folks are seeing this need well beyond here in Boston and in Massachusetts. And what we're hoping is that we can, from this experience, provide a model for how to create affordable senior housing that's LGBTQ welcoming. So one of the things that we haven't talked about is also how LGBTQ elders are more likely to face housing instability and homelessness. And the Greater Boston Food Bank just issued its report this week, and it's one of the highest families to experience poverty and food insecurity are LGBTQ families. So you know that we're starting off behind the eight ball before we even get to our retirements and old age. And so affordability is key as we meet the needs for our elders to be able to age in place, to be able to age with dignity and joy and all of the fabulousness about them being present in their everyday lives.
So actually, I'll just flag that we're going to have the Greater Boston Food Bank and Project Bread on tomorrow talking about food insecurity in the Commonwealth right now. So thank you for that reminder. I think my last question to you, Gretchen, you gave an incredible sort of litany at the beginning of our conversation about what our older adult generation of LGBTQ members have experienced, have gone through. Do we owe something in particular to this generation?
I certainly feel that I do. I know that I stand on the shoulders of the people who sacrificed so much to bring us changes in the law, to bring us marriage equality. I remember meeting David and Rob during the litigation and what phenomenal and courageous people they are and all the plaintiffs in that lawsuit. We definitely owe all of our elders a way to age in the way that they want to. But this is very much a continuation of Stonewall. This is revolutionary in the senior housing and affordable housing world, and we can't wait to take this revolution bigger and broader and have Pride 2, Pride 3, Pride 4, you name it. We're going to keep on going.
All right. That is Gretchen Van Ness, Executive Director of the Boston nonprofit LGBTQ Senior Housing. Gretchen, thank you. We've also been joined by David Wilson, president of the Residents Association at the Provincetown Independent Living Center, Seashore Point. David, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Let's go to the theater, The Huntington, where they are taking a fresh look at the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Common Ground, A Turbulent Decade in the Lives of Three American Families. It's by J. Anthony Lucas. Some call Common Ground the Bible of Boston, and when it was published in 1985, the Globe said, quote, "It is Boston's story, and it is tragic," end quote. Common Ground recounts the story of the 1974 decision by Judge W. Arthur Garrity to bus students across Boston in order to integrate the city's schools. What followed is famous: riots, protests, adults throwing stones at children on their way into school buildings, racial tensions that spilled over throughout the city, some parents even keeping their kids out of school. Well, now playwright Kirsten Greenidge and director Malia Bensusan are taking a fresh look at this story, told through the perspective of three Boston families, two white, one black, two in public housing, across Roxbury, the South End, and Charlestown.
Until y'all told me about it, I had no idea about this book. If it's a Bible, I'm sitting miles away at a different church.
If reporters read it and write our news, and teachers read it and teach our kids, and cops read it and walk our neighborhoods, it shapes how so many people come to learn about this city. It's children. We need to talk about this book, y'all.
That is Maurice Emanuel Parent and Shanae Birch as members of the ensemble. And joining us now, Kirsten Greenidge and Malia Bensusan, who talk about this 74 story in 2022. Kirsten, Malia, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you so much.
It's great to have you. I was still in my head there. I stumbled a little because I was still in my head in that scene from last night. I was at the show last night, and you make so many very specific decisions about how you want to bring this story forward. I think I'll start there. Kirsten, this is a 600-page tome that sort of has defined perceptions of Boston for more than a generation. How do you tackle something like this on stage?
Well, I will say that we've had the benefit of working on it for a very long time. Malia brought me on to collaborate about, we keep saying 10 years, but it's really been 11. In that span of time, we've had a lot of time to sift through the book and make some decisions about wanting to focus on the two young women, the two teenagers in the story, Cassandra Twyman and Lisa McGough, who lend their stories to Tony Lucas's book.
And they represent Roxbury and Charlestown.
Correct, yes.
Go ahead, sorry. I just wanted listeners to know that.
Oh, no, no. And so we made a decision to focus on two of the individuals who were living that experience by actually going to school each day, or, as we've found out, by doing more research and listening to Bostonians who were part of that desegregation experience, not going to school and feeling like school was not a safe place or productive place for them. So that's where it took us a few years to get to that. For a while, we had so many stories, and the playwright Naomi Zucker likes to use this analogy when talking about plays. If you have a piece of jewelry and you put all the stones on it, the jewelry or the necklace crumbles and falls, and it's not functional. So part of our job was to figure out how to make this a functional vehicle for the theater, and that was by slimming down a bit.
And I'm going to turn to Malia in just a second, but because of the analogy you just used, I'm going to stay with you, Kirsten. So what are the diamonds in this story that you wanted to pull forward?
Those young people's experiences, the juxtaposition of race and class in this city, and then how we also are revisiting this book that has meant so much to many and also been a point of contention for so many. So we wanted to be able to include that conversation in the experience of the theater piece.
So, Malia, that's really sitting in my head. I was thinking as I was watching the show last night, I was aware of this 10 or 11 year process to bring this forward, and thinking, okay, it's 2011, and one is thinking we need to revisit Common Ground. Okay, but now we're in 22, and a lot has happened in the last 2 years, and there's so much when you watch it on the stage where you think, that is today. In these last couple of years, in this last push to bring the play to the stage, how did it feel to have events around you change so much in the direction of inquisition is not quite the right word, query, right?
Inquiry.
About our history.
It's true inquiry. And I think, you know, it's the Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times, that we really buckled down with a production plan for this in, say, around February of 2020. We were going to produce it in December of 2020 originally. So we've gone from a very vague developmental, you know, we say 10 years, but Kirsten and I were both doing a million other things. Kirsten is one of the most commissioned playwrights, I think, in the United States. She has so many projects she's working on. So during those 10 years, we visited it sporadically. But these last couple of years, you know, starting in February 2020, we were like, we are doing this. Let us filter through what we've learned. And then came the pandemic. And as one of our characters says, our quote unquote racial reckoning. And so it was like suddenly being infused, I don't know, you know, on steroids of information. It was drinking from fire hydrants and all those other metaphors, because there was so much happening and all our material suddenly seemed more relevant than it had seemed at any other point in our process. Wouldn't you agree, Kirsten? I mean, it was terrifying how much every time we got together to work with this company of actors, for most of these actors have been with us these last couple of years, we, and most of our work prior to this last February was on Zoom, but we would be astonished by how relevant what the characters we were creating or reimagining or capturing, what their language and what their concerns were.
Go ahead. Yes, I mean, Amelia just used the word terrifying, and terrifying in terms of times, but also in, okay, all this information now, how do we apply it to the writing? So there could have been a little bit of terror, especially once you get a production date actually solidified and it has to go up.
So we are talking to playwright Kirsten Greenidge and director Amelia Bensusan about Common Ground Revisited, which is playing at the Huntington. I'm going to play a little sound here, so let me set this up. You do introduce some new characters into the play, and one of them is Ruth Batson, the chairwoman of the Education Committee of the NAACP, who, by the way, in a memoir later called Lucas's book Common Ground, or called Lucas a faulty historian. And I want to play a little sound of the character Ruth Batson talking with Louise Day Hicks, who was former head of the Boston School Committee, was in the U.S. House, ran for mayor of Boston. She was closely associated with the anti-busing movement, and as you note in the play, was a bit of a Rorschach test for both sides at the time. Here's that sound.
I came up going to meetings with my mother, Marcus Garvey, Africa for Africans. So from a very early age, I heard and knew about the struggle for more.
This is the United States of America, and Boston is a wonderful place to grow up.
I am not swayed by this business of Boston being such a wonderful place to grow up. There are flaws in this cradle of liberty.
That's not really in here.
There's more than one book.
Okay, so just quickly, Elle Borders there is Ruth Batson, Karen McDonald is Louise Day Hicks, and that was also Omar Robinson, who's in the ensemble. I want to ask the two of you how important it was to be a white woman and a woman of color collaborating on this story that is about the racial history and racial tensions of our time. Amelia.
You know, as you asked that question, I'm filled with a sense of awe and gratitude for our collaboration. We first collaborated, Kirsten and I, and we were matched by the Huntington Theater. So it is to that institution's credit that we've been working together all these years on Kirsten's amazing play, The Luck of the Irish. And what struck me when we were working on The Luck of the Irish, which is Kirsten's play that dealt with some of the issues around redlining and race in Boston around home buying. But I would be in rehearsal rooms with Kirsten where half the room was black presenting, and half the room is white presenting. We all have different backgrounds. But to be in a room where conversations around race and city living and education are spoken of honestly and candidly with all our perspectives from our various backgrounds around race and socioeconomic class and religion, it's really been an extraordinary privilege to be in these rooms and sharing space with Kirsten as we create these works.
And how about for you, Kirsten, and being mindful that you are creating the dialogue and the stories for white families and black families at a highly racially charged time?
First of all, I am always grateful to work with Melia, grateful and joyful, even though this topic is really difficult. And I often find myself looking to her expertise in terms of how to bring the work into the room off the page, which she does really, really well. I think that it has been important to have a team that is biracial on this project to be able to enter into these conversations and possibly go places where where cast members might be afraid to go if there was just one of us at the helm. And I would say that I don't want to speak for Melia about
you can you always can.
She presents. She is a Latina. White presenting Latina woman, and I value that experience and her experience and Jewish as well. And so I value all of her multiplicity of experiences as we sit in the rehearsal room day after day. It is wonderful to have her experience and to see how our experiences meld together, which I think is important in any collaboration, but particularly in this one.
So I want to play a little sound here from Act Two of the play. And this is looking at the Charlestown family and Charlestown culture at the time. Here it is.
Baked into the DNA, rooted under the pavement of Charlestown, is this idea of community, and that community is all. I mean, the individual as well.
Growing up, you were a townie. Guess what that meant? Automatically, you were tough, you were Irish, you were a Democrat, and you were Catholic. In that order. And you were damn proud of it. You were very proud. That was your identity.
So Michael Kay there is part of the ensemble. Amanda Collins is Alice McGough, the matriarch of the family who leads some anti-busing protests in Charlestown. One of the things that's interesting about watching this story unfold on stage is that many of the people you're talking about are still alive. And these are stories about communities and choices that families and individuals made who can then give you feedback, right? Yes. People who grew up in these neighborhoods who lived this as their own experience. And I know sometimes you've gotten pushback. How have you thought about that, Melia? And what have you done about that, Kirsten? Melia?
Well, you know, specifically, if I can just, I know you're asking about the families themselves, and happy to address that as well.
But also people from these neighborhoods.
Well, so that's what I wanted to speak to. The clip you chose is so wonderful because what happened to us after a matinee this past weekend, right? Because we're in previews, which means Kirsten and I are in the theater every day making changes, before the performance and then giving notes after the performance. So we're in the theater and recognizable. We've been doing some pre-show speeches. And so a woman and a friend of hers came up to us. We were sitting in the back and said with a great Charlestown accent, I was one of those Charlestown moms. And here is something you are not taking into account. And she told us a story of her son when he was a third grader and was bused across town from Charlestown. And the anecdote she told us about his experience and her feelings about busing because of her children actually made it into the next performance. So the conversations that we're having with this city, with its residents, with the people who have been through this and with people who are just learning about it, those conversations are, to paraphrase Kirsten here, are part of now the DNA of this show.
And Kirsten, it's a living, breathing show. I was struck by the fact that last night you both came out on stage before the production, said this was essentially a trial run. People had pages sometimes on stage that they were reading because you were rewriting as you went. Is that still happening? And are those constant rewrites an attempt at fidelity or just your vision changing? Tell me about that.
I think first and foremost, it is definitely part of the new play process, particularly part of my process. If you have the rehearsal time and the ability and to fix things. My philosophy is one should do that, is theater is a living experience. I feel a tremendous amount of onus to try to make sure that that this piece is not doing any more harm than living through Boston's desegregation in the 70s already has done. Trying to honor the three families, knowing that it must be incredibly hard to see your life rendered on stage in this way, or on film as it was in the several decades ago, or in the book where Tony Lucas is making decisions about what he wants to put in the book and what he might not be able to, in terms of the story he's telling, and also in terms of this book probably could have easily been 4,000 pages, having access to all of his records and taking. There's a lot more information that he culled. But I do want to make sure that if someone has lived in this city or lived through desegregation in this city, that they see a little bit of themselves. I cannot promise that I can tell every story fully and wholly, as it is a 2-hour play. And also, I'm not living those people's experiences. But it's very important to me that someone who knows the city and or knows what we call busing, desegregation, can say, I saw the play and part of it spoke to me. I know not all of it will speak to everybody. So my going back in there and rewriting is part of that. And also, we are living during a pandemic, and theater during a pandemic is really, really difficult.
Yeah.
So we are also dealing with a lot of COVID cases during our process, where we are also needing to fix things that we weren't able to get to a few weeks ago.
All right, that is Kirsten Greenidge and Melia Bensusan, playwright and director of the new play Common Ground Revisited. It's at the Huntington's. It's at the Huntington until June 26th. Kirsten, Melia, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
For the last few weeks, we have brought you a series of conversations on leadership. We call it Stepping Up, and it's all about talking with folks in and around the greater Boston area who are making deep change in their communities. Last week, we spoke with Jen Fagel of Commonwealth Kitchen, which is a nonprofit that helps support inclusive food entrepreneurship in the city of Boston. We've also heard from Geeta Pradhan of the Cambridge Community Foundation, Reverend Willie Bodrick II of the historic 12th Baptist Church, and Doug Rao, former president of Trader Joe's and founder of the nonprofit grocery store chain The Daily Table. Each conversation has keyed in on a specific moment or a decision or an approach to leadership. And as we look to explore what it takes to step up and lead, what it costs of those who do, and as we try to understand what might be preventing some of the next generation of leaders from stepping up and how we can help clear that path. So today, I'm very pleased to conclude this series with a conversation partly about being thrust into leadership. What does it mean to be asked to step up in a moment that turns out to be historic? And once you've made history, what do you do next to serve? Well, that's a question for Boston City Council President Kim Janey, who became Boston's first woman and first person of color to serve as acting mayor. Joining us here in Studio 2, former acting mayor of Boston and now CEO of Empath, an anti-poverty agency, Kim Janey. Madam Mayor Kim, welcome.
It is so great to be here. Thank you.
Oh, I'm really looking forward to this conversation. And I think the first thing I'll ask you is it fair to think about you as one who had some positions of leadership, but then was thrust into a whole new kind of leadership?
You know, for me, I have always believed either you step up or you step aside. And in my family, in my community, I saw examples of leadership. I saw the ways that community leaders organized. Heard some of your earlier segment around busing. As you know, I was thrust into that as a young child. So I, you know, saw examples of leadership and what it meant to love your community and work for a better community. And so I kind of carried that with me throughout my career in the nonprofit space. I have 25, 30 years experience working in the nonprofit sector, mostly here in Boston. I have taken that with me in elected office as I ran for District 7 City Council, Council President, and then serving as Mayor of Boston. I believe it is important for us to also look for and tap into a non-traditional leadership. And so I think, you know, leadership in Boston has looked a certain way, particularly if we're thinking about the highest office, serving as mayor. It has always been white. It has always been male. But there are community leaders in every single neighborhood who deserve to be recognized. They deserve to have their voices heard. And the things that they care about, we need to all make sure that there is space for different voices when we think about leadership.
So that's intriguing because you said a second ago or a minute ago, I believe you either step up or you step aside. Are you saying that it is actually time for some members of our community to step aside?
Well, I was not saying that. I was not saying that at all, but if this isn't for you, because you've got to have courage, you have to be willing to make hard decisions, you have to be willing to go where no one has gone before. And if that isn't you or something that you want to do, then yes, you should step aside and let those who are willing to take those risks, who are willing to kind of be courageous and take those first steps and blaze that new trail, then we've got to make room. And so I'm not necessarily saying that there are folks who are in the way who need to step aside, but I am saying it is important to recognize leadership in non-traditional forms. It's important to cultivate leadership, make sure that you are pouring back. I had a lot of folks throughout my entire life, folks who mentored me, who coached me, who cared about me, who offered sound advice. And to this day, you know, I turn to folks for advice, and I think we all do or should. And so it is important for those who have been in leadership to make sure that you are pouring into a new generation, for sure.
It's interesting to hear you talk about the people who've stepped up for you, supported you and mentored you. You know, as a young person, as an adolescent, I know there were people who wrote you off. You were pregnant at a young age. You have talked about kind of the culture of condemnation around that. You did not write yourself off.
No.
Who helped you have that strength?
You know, I think more than anyone, my daughter. I didn't have the luxury of being written off. I didn't have, even though people wrote me off, I couldn't let that be the end result. I couldn't let that be, you know, where I would end up because I had a daughter now. And so she really served as a motivating force to create better opportunities for her. And so I am grateful for all those who stood by my side and, you know, all my aunties and folks who were there. It's very difficult. I don't know how many of the listeners can relate, but being young, a teenager still in high school, scared, pregnant, you know, being told your life is over, feeling like your life is over, not, you know, knowing how you know, where you're even going to sleep the next day. You know, that things became very difficult at home. And so it was very difficult, but I'm grateful. I'm so grateful for the individuals who poured into me, who stuck with me, and for the institutions who were there for me.
Sometimes when I would talk to you when you were acting mayor, there are questions you want to ask that you either know, I can't ask it this way right now, or they're not going to be able to answer it this way right now, but we're in a different place now. And I find myself wondering sometimes, were there moments when you were serving as acting mayor where you felt like you were teetering on a ledge? You were going to make a big jump, but you weren't sure you were going to cross the distance from this side of the chasm to the other side with something you were trying to do. Did you ever have those moments?
Well, you know, leading the city of Boston was an amazing experience. I love my city. There are so many beautiful, wonderful things about Boston that are still true to this day that I appreciated throughout my life. So, that being said, it is challenging. You know, there is a lot of work. There is, and not just because it's a big job. There's a lot of work when your job is, or as you see your job, is to right many of the wrongs of the past. So, you know, there is a 400-year history of discriminatory policies that, you know, I wanted to tackle. Now, you can't do all of that in a couple of months. You can't do it in the span of a year. You can't even do it in a 4-year term. So, you know, what I am proud about is planting the seeds and starting that work and creating a foundation for that work to continue.
COVID, you know, police scandals, Patrick Rose, Dennis White, our great racial reckoning in the United States. You're standing in this moment with so much reform that needs to be done, so much you've decided to do. And I do wonder if you ever thought, kind of, darn it, why am I the one that's got to do all of this? There have been people in this role before me. Why am I having to try to do it all?
Well, you know, those are conversations I think you have with your creator. Like, those are conversations. Why me, Lord? You know, or, you know, if that's what you need me to do, then send me, Lord. You know, that is what I'm going to do. Many folks said, you know, at that time that, you know, this had to be from on high, because, you know, here you are thrust into this at this time when all of this is happening. And so this must be, you know, what you have been called to do. If that is the case, I mean, I think my calling certainly is related to, I don't know if I was specifically called to be mayor, but I guess so. I was specifically called to lead at that specific time my city. And I wanted to answer that call and I wanted to give it my all. And that's what I'm going to do in everything that I do. So whether it is public office and working in city government, if that is working in the nonprofit sector, if that is just how I care about my community, I want to give it my all, and I want to make sure that I am leaving this place better than how I found it. That's a principle, I think, that many of us were taught by our moms. You know, you go to a friend's house, I always got the lecture, make sure you leave it better than how you found it. And so that's what I wanted to do as mayor, and that's what I want to continue to do throughout my career and life.
So that idea of calling,
yes,
speaks to me. I understand that. And I wonder, so you're thrust into this role. You then ask to be given the role. The voters choose someone else. How did, looking back now, what's the train of thought there? So I was called to this role. It was an important moment. I stepped up in every way I could. But this is not what comes next for me. What happens in that moment?
Well, you know, I think for me, I have always tried to be very clear about the work, that it wasn't about titles, that we all have a role to play, and that the work is so big, the work has to get done. And so whether I am disrupting poverty as mayor of Boston, whether I am doing that through my advocacy for children in Boston Public Schools, whether I'm doing that in my new role as president and CEO of Empath, the focus has to be the work. And so that is what I believe my calling is. My calling isn't tied to specific titles. Though now I've been racking up titles.
You have.
Doctor, mayor, president, CEO. It isn't about the titles. It is about the work. And for me, it is about how we strengthen our communities, how we provide supports for family and children, how we disrupt poverty and create opportunities using an equity lens for everyone in our city and our Commonwealth and our country. And so for me, the focus is about the work. And if as long as I stay focused on my calling and why I was created, my purpose in life, then I feel good.
Earlier in the conversation, you talked about some institutions that really stepped up for you when you needed it. Empath is the latest version of an organization that's been around a long time and that did step up for you.
Absolutely. And I am just so grateful to lead Empath as the new president and CEO. This organization has nearly 200-year history. two important legacy organizations came together to form MPATH. One was the Women's Educational Industrial Union, and the other was Crittenton. Mm-hmm. When I was that young teenager pregnant, it was Crittenton that provided services and an opportunity for me as a young pregnant teen to continue my studies, to stay in school, and to graduate with my peers on time. Back when I was in high school, which was a very long time ago, and it was very different. And so it was not typical to see pregnant teenagers in high school. Oftentimes, you had to quit school altogether. That was the end. As I said, people told me my life was over. But it was Crittenton that allowed me to continue my studies. So I took a semester. It was pretty much the semester from September to January of my junior year. And I went to school through Crittenton. I was able to continue my studies, my same courses that I was taking in high school at Crittenton. I had a lot of small group support around studies. And in addition to your academic work, they helped us with parenting. And so there were girls at Crittenton during the time that I was there from 13 all the way to 19, and maybe even 20 if you were still in high school. And so that was life-changing for me, life-changing.
So we have a little bit, about a minute left. So what is a piece of wisdom that you gained from that life-changing experience that you're bringing into your service as the head of that organization now?
Well, it is the importance of giving people opportunity. It is the importance of mentoring and helping young people, helping young parents, helping parents regardless of their age. When you strengthen that family, you are strengthening community. And that is something that I learned after Crittenton, but as a young adult, as a young community organizer. And so leading in this new role, this organization that has a very unique model of direct service, of research and policy and advocacy, of economic mobility coaching and mentoring, that really can take low-income parents and help them double their income in a short period of time. And so this is a proven method. We have a global learning network getting this word out all across the country. And I'm just so thrilled and grateful to be able to pay it forward and pour into new generations like was done for me. So
that is Kim Janey, who served as acting mayor of the city of Boston, the first woman, first person of color to do that, and is now CEO of the nonprofit organization MPATH. Thanks for talking with us about stepping up.
Oh, thank you so much. It was great being here with
you. Great to have you. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening today. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.